Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Eyewitnesses in Tehran say riot police fired live bullets in the air and used tear gas to try to crush a rally in Tehran. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard says protesters will face a revolutionary confrontation. A BBC reporter has been expelled from the country, several foreign journalists arrested, and due to safety concerns about Britain's foreign office, they say they are evacuating the families of staff based there. The situation in Iran is being described as increasingly uncertain. Scott Peterson is with the Christian Science Monitor. Scott, you were reporting from Iran, but your visa expired. Now you're in Istanbul. What are you hearing from Iran?
Well, what I'm hearing about from people in Iran, sources and journalists and others who are keeping very close eye on the situation, is that there really is a large degree of uncertainty about several different things going on at the moment. One is they're not sure whether or not it's worth going out speaking to protesters. They're not sure whether it's worth going out risking the levels of violence that clearly are awaiting them, because they're not sure about what the result is going to be. This hasn't been spelled out yet. They're also uncertain about the Mir Hossein. But his plan is, too, he, of course, was very encouraging about people going out on the streets yesterday, but again, without any kind of game plan on where this is going to go.
Okay, you mentioned Mir Hossein Mousavi, who, of course, is the opposition leader, the candidate who came in second to sitting President Ahmadinejad. And, Scott, you're on a tough cell phone line, but we're going to keep you there because it's so important to get this information. Tell us more. Mousavi had urged his followers to continue to protest, saying the revolution is your legacy, but that was before today. Have we heard from him today?
Well, we haven't heard from him today, and in fact, we're not actually hearing from him. In fact, even his followers really only hear what his hopes are, either by catching a glimpse of something that he has posted on one of his internet sites or through word of mouth. It's very difficult now for people to communicate with each other using text messages or using any of their other more normal or more traditional means. But after Saturday's clashes, and they really were very serious clashes, there were thousands and thousands of people who tried to turn out for rallies. That was also the first day after the Supreme Leader had laid down the law, essentially, on Friday during Friday prayers. He said that there will be no more protests. These are illegal from this point forward, and they will simply not be acceptable, and they will be crushed. So Saturday was kind of the first test, and today we've had the second test, if you will, on the streets. There were perhaps as many as 1,000 people, based on reports that are coming from Tehran, but of course the security forces were all waiting at precisely the places where those protesters had meant to be, so there was no chance of anyone ever spending much time there.
And you said people seem to be afraid to go out. Later in the hour, we're going to hear from the woman who runs the Tehran Bureau website, and she's hearing the same thing. Today's rally was to be in memory of the woman named Neda Agasultan. This is a woman in a very disturbing video. She appears to die right on camera during Saturday's protest. You've written about her. Is there a sense that this is no longer about Mousavi, if it ever was, but has shifted to being about people like Neda?
Well, I think to start with, it certainly was about people making sure that their vote really was heard. In the early days, this was the primary protest. I mean, of course, they came behind Mousavi because he was the one who was the default candidate. It's not that people are completely in love with someone who was the prime minister during the 1980s. This is a very uncharismatic man. But he also has since then proven to have had a lot more mettle, I think, than both his supporters and also the regime ever counted on him having. I mean, he's still really right in the face of the Supreme Leader in terms of his countering and resistance, in terms of trying to keep these protests going on. And, of course, what we saw on Saturday, this incredibly violent scene, this video of this young woman passing away, really has become one of the iconic images of this event. And so people who are protesters, they're using that as one of their rallying cries. And so today was meant to be a memorial event for her.
Well, and she's being called, as you report, the Angel of Iran. But as we're hearing, Revolutionary Guard and riot police cracking down on protesters. Just very briefly, Scott, I mean, it takes a crystal ball, but in the few seconds we have, what happens now?
Well, I think that there will probably be another attempt tomorrow and maybe one the next day. I mean, to be honest, I think that if the military and the riot police continue to be out on the streets in the degree of force that they are, then what I understand is that probably the protesters are going to have to come up with another game plan. Now, that may be, and we've heard this, perhaps a national strike, right, perhaps a sit-in at the shrine of Imam Khomeini. There are several options, but not too many that will be effective, probably.
Scott Peterson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey, where he's been monitoring the situation in Iran. Scott, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
And let's turn now to Azar Nafisi. She's professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Her literary memoir of life in the Islamic Republic, of course, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her latest book about her childhood and family is called Things I've Been Silent About. And Professor, we know you've been following this story very closely. First of all, your thoughts on today's report, as we just heard, eyewitnesses saying the government attacking protesters today.
Robin, obviously, it very much saddens me, the fact that the government is going to be persistent in cracking down rather than opening at least some form of a space for dialogue. But you can also appreciate and be encouraged by the persistence of these protesters who have basically nothing but their voices and going out into the streets. From the very start, I had been putting my bet on those voices, and I still am.
Well, and yours, do I understand yours was one of the voices in 1979?
Mine was one of those voices in 1979. At first, we started shouting in Washington, D.C., in front of the White House, U.S. advisors, CIA agents out of Iran, and saying death to the Shah. And later on, almost nonstop, after the revolution, mine became a voice of dissent, first in regards to the rights of Iranian women, where there were hundreds of thousands of women coming out into the streets saying freedom is neither Western nor Eastern, freedom is global, and later during the Cultural Revolution. So I have been part of those voices, and now I so much admire
today's
protesters.
Voices.
Yes.
Well, it
yes.
gets very complicated because their leader, the leader of today's movement, is Mir Hussein Mousavi, the candidate who lost to Ahmadinejad. But in the early years, right after the 1979 revolution, he became your oppressor. He shut down the university you were teaching in.
This is the ironic aspect of life in general, but this revolution in particular, that me and my husband and many of our friends have been musing over, especially over the past few days. At the beginning, during the Cultural Revolution, where the government had a terrible crackdown, I mean, some of the scenes happening now remind me of then. For example, the students who were murdered by the police, their bodies were snatched from the hospitals so that people could not prove that they had been killed. And Mr. Mousavi was responsible. And any of the slogans that his campaign is encouraging today, when they were said then, people would be facing the same kind of punishment. I think it is both ironic and it's also a testament to Iran and its civil society. The domestic unrest and dissatisfaction has helped create deep rifts within the ruling elite. And Mr. Mousavi is the best example of why this system has failed.
Well, but do you think he really has changed, that he's, as some people have said, morphed into the candidate the people needed him to be? Do you think he is the reformer now?
Well, it is very difficult for me to say that. I know that many people who were supporters and architects of the revolution have now changed their mind or changed their sides.
Yeah, you being one of them.
Yes, but there are two points that we should remember about Mr. Mousavi. One, the fact that someone like him, as well as the former speaker, Mr. Karoubi, or for that matter, the former head of Revolutionary Guards, Mohsen Rezaei, they are now, in one way or another, to varying degrees, are seen as opposition to the regime, shows that if Mr. Mousavi is not 100% behind these slogans, I mean, in his heart of hearts, he sees no other option. He sees his own survival in becoming more liberal, and I welcome that, because the change is so deep. It comes from within and not just from without.
But it's not as deep, we should rush to say, as many Westerners think. It's more complicated in a way, because we tend to think revolution means overthrow, and it did in 1979 when the clerics led the overthrow of the Western-backed Shah of Iran. We're told it doesn't mean overthrow of the Islamic Republic today. It just means more demand for rights, for instance, and less power in the hands of the clerics. But do you think that after all the demonstrations and the crackdowns, that might change, that it might mean overthrow?
I think this is what Mr. Khamenei, and I think actually to some extent Mr. Mousavi, are frightened of. This regime has already seen that if you create a small space for freedoms, people immediately want more, because this is what the Iranian society wants, in fact, more. And I think this crackdown is based on the fear that they will not be able to control it. And I do understand that. And as you say, things are more complicated, and Mr. Mousavi at some point could also back down. But this movement, I think, will go on and come back sooner or later.
We're talking with Professor Azar Nafisi from Johns Hopkins University, but also, of course, the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. And I just want to ask you about how your book is sort of resonating now, because it focused on the life of women in the early years of the Islamic Republic, the growing oppression that you told us about, oppressive rules about clothing and public behavior, which forced you out of your university and into teaching surreptitiously in your home. Today, we feel we're seeing women at the forefront of this movement. Are we? Are we seeing a different woman?
That was exactly what I have been trying to say, actually, in my books and in my articles. The fact that women have become the canaries in the mines. In Reading Lolita in Tehran and in my new book, Things I've Been Silent About, the central thesis is that Iranian women have a past, and they have been fighting for their rights for over 100 years. So when the Islamic regime clamped down on their rights and imposed some of the most reactionary rights on them and took away their spaces, they did not give up. Those women, the students that I talk about in my book, they came from different viewpoints. Some of them, like Mahshid, were devout Muslims, and some were devout seculars. And yet, both the seculars and the Muslims felt the pressure and felt that religion should be a personal matter and not a matter for the state. And that pressure has led to Iranian women becoming even more visible today.
Well, as we heard earlier, there is already an iconic female image, Neda, a young woman who died on camera during Saturday's protest. We want to ask you about her when we come back with Johns Hopkins professor Azar Nafisi, also author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. We'll ask about the iconic images coming out of Iran in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're speaking with Johns Hopkins professor Azar Nafisi. She marched in Iran's 1979 revolution to overthrow the Western-backed Shah of Iran, but also then protested the repressive regime that replaced him, ultimately writing the book Reading Lolita in Tehran, about being forced to teach women in secret. And Professor, two women have emerged in this most recent uprising. As you indicated, they seem to represent different cultural ideas, but one political belief. One is a woman in a full headscarf. She's shielding an Iranian policeman from an angry crowd of opposition demonstrators during Saturday's demonstration, seeming to say, we're not going to stoop to his violence. The second is Neda, the woman who dies on camera in a terrible video shot during that demonstration. Her head is uncovered. She's dressed in Western style. You've said women are the canaries in the coal mine, and they are in literature as well. The story of Scheherazade tells of the young girl who refuses the king's violence.
the whole idea with Shahrazad was that the king in that country, it was supposed to be Persia, the king in the country, his wife, the queen, commits adultery, and the king becomes so angry that not only does he kill her, but every night he marries a virgin, and before they can betray him, he kills them in the morning. And Shahrazad decides to save her city and to save the men and women living there. So she volunteers to become a bride. And what she does, she cures the king by refusing to go into his domain, which is the domain of violence and the domain of monologue, no dialogues, no colors, sense of justice. And she tells him stories every night. And every night she leaves the story unfinished. So the king becomes curious to know the ending of the story. And for 1,001 nights, she tells him the stories, showing him that the world is not black and white, that there are good women and bad women. And through that, Shahrazad cures the king. And this is what the Iranian women are doing today.
Is there another word, Sherazan, for lioness? Or did I hear that?
Shirzan, one? Yes. That means a lioness, a woman who protects her turf in one sense. And the fact that the two images you brought, I think, prove two points. One is that Iranian women are not divided by the way they look at religion. They are, in fact, united because they know that the laws oppress both the woman who is veiled and the woman who is unveiled. And the second thing, which is very important, is that they are not using the same tactics that the regime uses. The regime fires into them. In response, they protect the guard. And I think that this will have an effect, not just on that one guard, but if this skirmish goes on, it will have an effect on the revolutionary guards who are now firing on the people.
What if it goes in the different direction? What if instead of a skirmish, it becomes a real Tiananmen Square-like crackdown? Does it then put the genie back in the bottle, as people have said? Does it push this story back decades?
I have faith in Iranian civil society, and nothing that has happened over the past 30 years has proved this faith wrong. Over the period of 30 years, we have seen outbursts and we have seen public protests, people using the open spaces to voice their grievances. And this usually happens during the time of elections because these candidates want to win the people over. But at every point, rather than this movement going back home and being disillusioned, comes back with a higher momentum. Remember Mr. Khatami's time and the disillusion. And now, 8 years later, look at how Iranian people are coming into the streets in droves. So I have faith.
It's hard to imagine, for instance, Zahra Ravnavard, the yes. wife of Mir Hussein Mousavi. We heard an interview she gave to the BBC where she admitted that she and her husband were unusual. He listened to her advice as much as she listened to his. They hold hands. She was attacked by the sitting president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. She's the first woman chancellor of an Iranian university since the Islamic Republic. It's hard to imagine her going to the back of the room again.
Well, you know, the triumph of Iranian people has been that people like Zahra Rahnavard, Faizeh Rafsanjani, the former President Rafsanjani's daughter who was just recently arrested.
And we should say, I think she's been released.
She's been released now, yes. Mm-hmm. And their fathers and husbands, who 30 years ago were on the other side, are now on this side. This is in itself a triumph for the Iranian civil society and especially for Iranian women. Had Mrs. Rahnavard been right, had Mr. Mousavi been right at the beginning of the revolution, they would be up there and we would be joining them. But the movement has been in reverse. They're mm-hmm. joining us down here rather than remaining up there. Mm-hmm. And even in this, I think there is a great deal of hope.
You spoke of how Mousavi had changed from someone who was your oppressor after the Islamic Revolution to now the man who's considered the reformer. And some of Mousavi's followers are calling him Iran's Mahatma Gandhi, that he's trying to remain nonviolent with nonviolent civil disobedience. Your thoughts on that?
I would not call Mr. Mousavi Mahatma Gandhi. People have to earn the titles that is bestowed upon them. I will give Mr. Mousavi credit for trying to keep this nonviolent and siding with some of the demands of the Iranian people. Mahatma Gandhi had a philosophy of life which he pursued to the end of his own life. And if Mr. Mousavi does that, then we will bestow the right title on him. But this is too early, and we should not be rushing into this sort of a judgment.
That's Azar Nafisi, a professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Reading Lolita and Tehran, and her latest book about her childhood and family is called Things I've Been Silent About. Professor Nafisi, thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we'll have the latest on today's crackdown on protesters in Iran in the newscast in just 1 minute. And also ahead, should the rich in the U.S. kick in more to bring down the deficit? Here and now. If you're following today's crackdown on protesters in Iran, you may have visited the website Tehran Bureau. The Boston Globe writes it's suddenly become the go-to source for information with Twitter feeds and stunning pictures, the Huffington Post of Iran, according to journalist Robin Wright. But the Tehran Bureau is not a bureau. It's not in Tehran. It's run by one woman on two Apple Power books in the living room of her parents' home here in Massachusetts. Kelly Niknajad joins us. Kelly, what are you hearing from Iran?
What I was hearing this morning is that, it's very quiet. People have closed up their shops. They've heard that the central organization is waning. So people have heard maybe there's a gathering here, maybe there's a gathering there, maybe there's one over here. So they're not sure. They don't know if they should go, if they shouldn't go. They're very scared to go.
You say you're hearing the central organization, I assume you mean of the opposition, is waning. Are people speculating as to why that is, what's happened?
It's because all their leaders are in jail. They've rounded them up, made it impossible for them to communicate.
You're not referring to Mir Hussein Mousavi, the candidate?
No, there's a list that we published last night. Some of the confirmed names that we had, Iranian bloggers and journalists and politicians that have been confirmed to have been rounded up. I'm sure it's just a partial list, but probably a drop in the bucket in terms of who they have.
Right. Well, how are you getting information? Because we understand that the Iranian government is doing deep research into internet use and is able to block even people who are trying to go around blocking. So how are you getting your information? And are you feeling that blocking?
We were massively attacked. Our website went down soon after the protest started. In terms of getting information out, yes, it's very difficult. It's continued to be difficult. We've had to sever our ties with those who had permission to report for Tehran Bureau, but no longer do. So we had to resort to other means. So no matter who or what gets blocked, there's still information, firsthand, credible information, that is going to trickle to us.
Right. Well, let's explain what your background is. You left Iran with your family when you were just 17. This was after the Iranian Revolution in 79. You didn't leave till 84, at the beginning of the war with Iraq, settled in the U.S., studied law, got two master's degrees from the Columbia Journalism School, have recently reported for an English language newspaper in Dubai. You have your journalism credentials. But why did you then go to a website? That seems like, at least initially, that was hiding your candle under a bushel a little bit.
No, but that's because the American media has not been very supportive. Even my professors would tell me, look, no one cares about Iran. And when I've tried to work within the establishment, within the mainstream media, they were only interested in hearing things that fit their stereotypes of what's going on in Iran.
Well, for instance, you are very much opposed to your website being seen as an opposition news organization. You resent the Western media that views what's happening right now as a move to topple the republic there. You don't see it that way.
No. I'm saying that it's wrong. Right now, a lot of these French diaspora groups, unfortunately, have been trying to hijack what's happening for their own failed causes over the past 30 years. It's great that we are showing solidarity. I think that's very important, but we've all had relatives who've been executed. We've all had a hard time. That's not about that. It's not about us. It's a little bit it's much more important than that.
Well, and we've heard that from other analysts, that the opposition is not about overthrowing the Islamic Republic, but bringing some democracy and rights to the existing government, the existing framework in Iran. And with that in mind, you don't restrict your reportage to the opposition. You say you've tried to reach out to others?
Yes. I mean, before all this happened, the idea behind Tehran Bureau was to, you know, reach out to the reformists, to the hardliners. You know, let me call you on the phone and get a quote from you. That was the point. The point was to have, you know, more nuanced reporting. Even if the mainstream media were to embrace me, I still would not have been able to do what I'm doing right now, because it takes a crisis and they get it and then it's too late.
Kelly, thank you so much. I understand you're not getting a lot of sleep these days, so we really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Kelly Nicknajad, editor of the Tehran Bureau website from her home in Newton, Massachusetts. Kelly, thanks again.
Thank you.
And we'll link to Tehran Bureau at our website, hereandnow.org. We're back in just 30 seconds with Pete Peterson, who wants you, me, all of us to help bring down the deficit here and now. The deficit this year could hit $2 trillion, and Blackstone private equity founder Pete Peterson is so worried about that that he donated $1 billion to a foundation to encourage Americans to demand fiscal responsibility. Pete Peterson became a billionaire at age 81 when Blackstone went public. Now he's out with a memoir called The Education of an American Dreamer, from small-town Nebraska to MIT to his part in getting supplies for the first atomic bomb. He then rose through the ranks of corporate America before becoming Commerce Secretary for Richard Nixon, then CEO of Lehman Brothers, and then, of course, the head of Blackstone. It's a great read. But today, Pete Peterson joins us to talk about his plans for bringing down the deficit. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the deficit. You supported the stimulus package, which aided the huge increase in the deficit. What are you suggesting that we do to bring it down?
We're obviously either going to have to cut benefits, which I think we're going to, for everyone except the truly needy, or we're going to have to increase taxes, or we're going to have to do both. But these debts and promises are so large that they're truly unsustainable. We'd have to double taxes on our kids. Well, that's not only unthinkable, it's immoral. I'd love to see 100,000 young people and their parents marching on Washington and saying, you know, we're madder than hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And we expect you people in the Congress to come up with solutions to these problems.
Well, and what would the solutions be? You've said, for instance, when it comes to Social Security, you've said we have a progressive income tax. In other words, people are taxed progressively more according to their incomes. Why don't we have a progressive benefit reduction? Is that a fancy way of saying should people who make over a certain income just not have benefits?
Yeah, for example, I've advocated some time ago a so-called affluence test. And what I propose is we'd take the median income, that's about $45,000, and above the median income, as the income went up, the benefits would get cut. And below the median income, we'd leave the benefits alone.
So when you say $45,000 as an average, you're talking about retirement benefits. But there will be people who will say, oh, wait a second, $45,000 isn't a lot for someone to live on. You can't take away our benefits.
Well, you know, the problem we have is we've gotten used to an entitlement system in which we all benefit. But the trouble with that concept, if everybody's on the wagon, who's going to pull it? If you just cut the benefits for the rich, you don't get enough cost savings to nearly make up for the huge magnitude of public promises. So you have to do that. But what I think we must emphasize is Americans aren't saving anything. And that only means we're not providing much for our own retirement, but we've become recklessly dependent on foreign lenders. And that is a highly risky thing to do. So what the program should be is a gradual reduction of benefits for people in the middle class and above the median income, and then a program to encourage people to save more.
What about taxing income before retirement? What about lifting the cap on the amount of income that's subject to the payroll tax, which funds Social Security? Some analysts say that could pay about three quarters of what's needed?
Well, it depends on where you put the limit. I'm all for increasing the marginal rate on us fat cats, you know, while we're still making it, which is when the big money is involved. Right now, for example, that would also produce a great deal of money. And I make that point because I don't want to sound like I don't think the rich should pay more taxes, because they must, given the inequality of incomes. But I give you this number. If you got rid of all the Bush tax cuts, not just the tax cuts for the well-off, but everybody, the whole program, which nobody is proposing, that's about 1% of the gross domestic product of the United States. If you then looked at how much the entitlement promises are and what the increase is, it's 9% of the GDP. So in other words, the benefit increases dwarf anything that you could imagine on the tax side. So I think it's going to take a balanced program of reducing benefits for people that don't need them, doing it gradually so people have time, and increase the taxes somewhat.
What about the debate in healthcare over whether or not to tax benefits?
I would be inclined personally to tax the benefits. And the reason I think it's sensible to tax those benefits is we've got a huge, huge cost problem in this country. One of the reasons for that is this tax-free getting of benefits. So this is one thing that encourages you to pile on the health care benefits, which, after all, is a form of compensation, if you want to think about it. If we started taxing these benefits, the consumer would become much more cost-conscious.
But do you really think that people are going out willy-nilly and having back surgery just because it's free?
No, but look at it this way. And I had a specific experience with backs. I had something called stenosis of the lower three vertebrae, and I had an MRI, and I go into this orthopedic surgeon, and he says, Pete, you're going to have surgery. The surgery costs $14,000. But, you know, when someone wants to do something just based on a quick visit of $14,000 and the consultation is only $250, you begin to wonder a little bit whether there's an incentive to do surgery. So I went to a sports doctor who did not do surgery, and I had him look at my MRIs, and he said to me, Pete, have you been told about epidural shots in your back? And I said, no, I haven't. He said, well, they work about 20 to 30% of the time. So I went to a pain management place and got these shots, and that was 15 years ago, and I haven't had back surgery. Now, I'm not saying these doctors are unethical, but if you make thousands of dollars for surgery and you make only a couple of $100 on a visit, we shouldn't be surprised that doctors are recommending all kinds of imaging and tests of various kinds and surgery and so forth. So we've got a very perverse cost incentive system in this country.
Well, so Pete Peterson, you are now applying your estimable skills to making Americans aware through your Peterson Foundation of just what the issues are with the deficit and with the high cost of health care. Just wondering, what do you say to people who say, well, you may be asking for reform, but you were on Wall Street, and you write in your book that just because you had been in the vicinity on Wall Street, that people were treating you like a horse trader that got a high price for a horse that you knew was lame?
Well, that's what one worries about, of course. But Blackstone's a very strong company. We're a long way from Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. But it is true, they permitted me to sell my stock, or 60% of it. But to be fair to the other partners, I had to give back 15% of my shares to make up for whatever advantage I had that I was liquid. No one in the world imagined that the stock would fall from 31 to where it is now, 11. But they knew that I intended to give the money away, and I had been a founder of the firm. And as I say, I think if I had kept the money and just piled it up on top of whatever I had before, I would have been subject to a lot more criticism. But the fact that I was giving it away, I hope most Americans would treat me a little bit differently, perhaps.
That's Pete Peterson. His new book is The Education of an American Dreamer, How a Son of Greek Immigrants Learned His Way from a Nebraska Diner to Washington, Wall Street, and Beyond. Pete Peterson, thanks so much for talking to us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back.
Wow, that is incredible. That's amazing. It's very heavy.
Oh, that is heavy.
That is a priceless piece.
Crew members of the treasure hunting company Odyssey Marine Exploration admiring a gold box pulled from a shipwreck in 2007 in a scene from the Discovery Channel documentary Treasure Quest. The Spanish government claims that the ship was the 200-year-old Spanish warship, the Mercedes, and so by law, the coins belong to them. Odyssey officials say other countries, Britain, for instance, have cooperated with them in excavating ships, so they're fighting the Spanish government over the estimated $500 million worth of undersea treasure. Recently, a Florida judge recommended that Odyssey return the loot. The company says it will file an objection. Odyssey is this country's only publicly traded deep-sea marine exploration company. Greg Stem is CEO and co-founder. He joins us. And, Greg, let's put aside the debate for a minute, because we know you often sell duplicate coins that you've found, and you haven't sold any of these coins yet. So, first question, where's all the loot?
Well, Robin, we've got them in a conservation lab where we're slowly going through them and photographing, documenting them, and preserving the coins. It's actually really expensive. It costs as much as $30 or $40 per coin. We can spend, you know, up to $10, $12 million for an archaeological excavation in the deep ocean. So whoever ends up with this, if Spain does end up with some of it or all of it, they've got a huge bill they're going to have to figure out how to pay.
Would you charge them if they do win in the final decisions?
Well, I don't know how it's going to play out. In this case, we felt very confident that if it was the Mercedes, it was clearly on a commercial mission. And ships that are on commercial missions are subject to salvage.
And that's the part of the law that you are citing. Of course, Spain is citing the part of the law they like, which is that warships belong to the countries that they sailed for. So, again, putting that aside for a second, if you get to retain this treasure, what do you want to do with it?
Our position from the very beginning is that you really need to involve everybody. The first thing we do is we take it into court and we put it in custody of a judge, and then the judge decides who would have an interest in the shipwreck. But then we reach out to any countries that may have interest. We reach out to any families that may have had something potentially on it. In the case of this shipwreck, we went to a bunch of the families that were descendants of people that carried the majority of the cargo on the Mercedes. We said, you know, this is something that I think your family would be interested in and you should be involved in.
So you do approach the people whose culture these artifacts come from. That's interesting because, as you all know, in 2001, UNESCO adopted a convention for the protection of underwater cultural heritage. It prohibits the selling of artifacts more than 100 years old. Now, the U.S. isn't a signatory, but you're saying you go to people and ask them, explore what relation they might have to these, but some people say, should you benefit at all from other people's cultural artifacts?
Well, I can't think of any field that people are prohibited from making a profit for the money that they invest, the time they spend, especially when they do good science.
But I'm wondering, you also have stockholders, which is highly unusual, and they expect a return. Is that part of a pressure on you to make money from the find?
Well, you know, most of the archaeology on land is done by, guess what, for-profit companies that expect a return for their shareholders. The difference is they usually supply services and are paid by governments for the services they provide. Odyssey's model, working with the British government or what we've suggested to other governments, is you have an option. If you really think that the cultural heritage should all be kept together in a collection, that's fine. All we ask is you just pay us a percentage of what we give back to you. And it's exactly the same thing that we've proposed to the Spanish government.
So you have proposed that they just pay you for what you found?
Absolutely. We've proposed several different deals to the Spanish government along the lines of the deal that we've already made with the British government, which is we take all the risk, we spend all the money, we do the best archaeology that anybody has ever done in the deep ocean. We present this entire collection to the government. The government looks at it and they say, well, either we'll give you a percentage of the coins, or we will keep all the coins together and we'll pay you a percentage of the value that you've recovered.
Tell us a little bit how you do your work with a remotely operated vehicle that descends to the ship. It's called an ROV, I understand?
Yeah, we use a large underwater robot, which we call a remotely operated vehicle. And we use basically the same technology that's used by the military or oil companies or fiber optic cabling companies to do very precise tasks in the deep ocean. And there's virtually nothing that a human can do that an ROV or robot can't do remotely.
Well, some marine archaeologists are concerned that the robots might not be as sensitive to artifacts as humans and destroy them. But meanwhile, it's not easy work. Odyssey personnel have been held up by the Spanish Civil Guard. You and your business partner were investigated by the SEC for overstating the value of artifacts. You fought that and won. But before you came to deep sea exploration, you worked in marketing. You worked on Bob Hope's tour once. How did you leap from that to a publicly traded company listed on NASDAQ that goes deep sea treasure hunting?
Well, I studied marine biology in college, and that's what I wanted to do. I got sidetracked for a while, but given the opportunity to get back into my real passion, which was messing around in the deep ocean, I dove in, if you will.
Well, and that surprises us, because there's a sad note in your biography. We understand that when you were very young, when you were 7, you were shark fishing with your grandfather when the boat capsized and he drowned. Now, some would think that would keep you off the water forever.
Well, you know, my parents did. It was a very traumatic thing, obviously.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's what's led to my passion about the deep ocean. You know, I fished a lot as a child, and I recall when you'd snag something in the water, I always just wondered what in the world that was, what was down there. And I always had this dream that you could sort of drain the oceans and see all these amazing and magical things down in the bottom of the ocean. And as I was growing up, of course, you had people like Jacques Cousteau that were peeling back the curtain to let us see what was in the deep ocean. And I feel really privileged to be part of a group of people that I think are peeling back a whole different piece of the ocean, not just the biology, but the amazing shipwrecks and cultural heritage that's lying down there.
Despite what the ocean took from you.
Despite what the ocean took from me, or maybe because of it.
Greg Stem, a CEO and co-founder of the publicly traded treasure exploration company Odyssey, in a court battle with Spain over the coins that his company discovered at the bottom of the sea. Greg, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Robin.